I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today on this installment of Living Questions, our series on religion in the public sphere, the state of religious freedom in the U.S. and abroad, and the role of religion in the dynamics of global politics. President Donald Trump has nominated a religious conservative to head the State Department's Office of International Religious Freedom, which monitors religious persecution and assists emerging democracies in their efforts to establish pluralistic societies. Is this theological nation building? The Reverend Dr. Serene Jones is the president of the Union Theological Seminary. Asma Houdin is a lawyer and scholar who specializes in religious liberty issues. They join me in Studio A. Plus, J. Wynn Russick reviews Lear at the Single Carrot Theater. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us for Midday today. Today, it's another edition of Living Questions. That's our monthly series on the role of religion in the public sphere, and we produce it in collaboration with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Today, a conversation about religious freedom in the United States. President Donald Trump continues to advocate for restricting access to the U.S. for Muslims from certain countries, and he nominated Sam Brownback, a strict religious conservative, to head the Office of International Religious Freedom in the State Department. Mr. Brownback, the highly unpopular governor of Kansas, will leave that post with the Kansas economy in shatters, but his appointment to oversee religious freedom worldwide is being hailed by evangelicals as a good choice. Perhaps his most well-known involvement with a religious freedom case in the U.S. is his advocacy for a Kansas florist who refused to make an arrangement for a same-sex couple's wedding. So what does that portend for America's posture in other countries, particularly where LGBT citizens face discrimination? Joining me today, the Reverend Dr. Serene Jones. She's the president of the Union Theological Seminary in New York. She is the first woman to head that historic institution. She holds the Johnston Family Chair for Religion and Democracy there. She is the immediate past president of the American Academy of Religion, and she served for 17 years on the faculty of Yale University. She joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Dr. Jones, welcome.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
And Asma Houdin joins us as well. She is the founder and editor-in-chief of AltMuslima.com and the co-founder of AltFem magazine and AltVentures Media. She is a lawyer and a scholar who speaks frequently about American and international religious liberty. She's at the NPR studios in Washington this afternoon. Ms. Houdin, welcome as well.
Thank you.
You are welcome to join our conversation here on this edition of Living Questions. Our number on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And to join the throngs of people who join us on Twitter, you can find us at Midday Tom Hall. So, Asma Houdin, I think it came as a surprise to me, and perhaps it comes as a surprise to a lot of people, that the U.S. State Department actually has an Office of International Religious Freedom, and that this office, which has been going on for 19 years now, is somewhat activist when it comes to issues of religious liberty around the world. As you understand it, what does this particular State Department office do, and what do they try to accomplish?
Well, the job of USERF, which is the acronym for the commission, is to monitor the state of religious liberty across the world and to advise the U.S. In terms of the status of religious liberty and the way that it can intervene and make things better with its own policies.
And do you think they're effective in that regard?
I think their effectiveness has been limited by various issues. I mean, there's always politics. The USERF, unfortunately, is riddled with a lot of politics internally and then externally in terms of the way that it's perceived and the way that this role generally is perceived. And also by the fact that religious liberty tends not to be a high priority issue at the State Department in terms of our foreign policy. And so, but I mean, I do agree that there is a role to be played and a need for this monitoring. And so to that end, I think that it serves a valid purpose.
And Dr. Jones, after monitoring issues of, you know, religious persecution, and you know, there continue to be these incidents around the globe. I think it probably is a good idea for the State Department to keep track of that. The mission statement of this office also says that it assists emerging democracies in implementing freedom of religion and conscience. That may strike some as sort of theological nation building. What's your take on that? Is that, in your view, a proper role for a U.S. government agency?
Well, insofar as creating conditions under which people can express their religious views and speak morally in a public sphere, yes, it's essential. I think just adding to Asma's points, one of the limitations, I think, of USRF has been that it has globally focused predominantly on what it considers to be the persecution of Christians, which has as a predominantly Christian nation, the U.S. has a very limited view of what freedom, what conscience looks like in the political sphere. And when you have a very restrictive notion of that, you can end up doing more harm than good in the name of protecting religious freedom.
And in that context, Sam Brownback, the soon-to-be former governor of Kansas, a strict religious conservative, I guess became a Roman Catholic about 15 years ago and still attends some evangelical churches in the Kansas area. What's your impression of his qualifications for this particular position, and what does it portend given the fact that his prior record when it comes to religion and conservative evangelical thought might portend a particular emphasis on Christian persecution as opposed to anything else?
Yes, I think we have reason for grave concern, knowing his background and his qualifications for the position are only insofar as I can see that he agrees with the present administration. But what has come out of the religiously conservative Christian political voice in this moment in time is an advancement not of a general religious freedom that takes into account multiple religious voices and the voices of people of conscience who may not be religious, but aggressively pursues the political and theological agenda of a particular slice of Christianity in the U.S., and that's conservative evangelical Christianity, which means we have a lot to worry about when it comes to the political issues that they set at the core of their agenda. We have a lot of concern about issues related to sexuality and LGBTQ issues, a lot of concerns about political slash theological positions on immigration, on policies towards Muslims and immigration, and the list goes on. It's a very frightening time.
And Asmahuddin, how about your take on the selection of Mr. Brownback, who's been nominated for this post? I mean, what's your expectation that his focus will be?
Well, during his confirmation hearings, he was asked explicitly by Tim Kaine, by Senator Kaine, about whether or not he would stand up for the rights of minorities and then Muslims specifically, and he very strongly said that he would stand up for those rights. So I think there's some positive signs there, and then Tim Kaine himself said has said that he thinks that Brownback is quite qualified for the position. In terms of, you know, issues beyond minorities and the question of placing emphasis on certain evangelical views, I come from a place where I think that religious liberty needs to always be sort of thought broadly as something that is that protects both minority religions and the majority, you know, majority views as well. The idea is to have that sort of neutrality in the space for people to engage in their, you know, to be able to exercise their religious beliefs despite the ways that those beliefs might be interpreted in the political space. And so I'm less concerned about that, hoping that he does have that type of holistic view on religious liberty as a space that's really there to allow for diversity and diverse opinions to exist, as opposed to, you know, opening space for government coercion to limit one at the expense of the other. And so to that end, I'm less concerned by that and heartened also by his explicit support for Muslim rights.
And in that regard, I mean, I think the people who are a little worried about Mr. Brownback and how he might use this office, they worry that his notion of religious liberty would sort of be, seen only through the prism of domestic American Christianity. Do you share that concern? And if so, what would your advice to him be? I mean, he's given some indications that he's open to a broader definition. But so in your heart, do you believe that that's true?
Well, I mean, I can only hope for the best, and I would hope that if he's appointed ambassador, that he will take the advice of others from a diverse set of religious communities and religious perspectives and informing him in the way that he deals with foreign policy and international religious liberty, and doesn't allow America and American culture wars to color the view of the way he sort of approaches things abroad.
And Dr. Jones, this notion of a religious right and a religious left, that seems to be a relatively new phenomenon, I mean, historically speaking. It's something that we take for granted now, the evangelical right and in the Catholic sense, of the liberation theology of the left, or whatever else you would call it in a more overarching sense for other sects of Christianity. But when did the, historically, I mean, when did people start divvying up the American Christian movement into what appear to be pretty hardened camps between the left and the right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's a very recent phenomena. I mean, since the beginning of this nation, there's been multiple religious views and multiple, even within Christianity, views. But this hardened right and left and the way it's worked itself out in terms of evangelical and progressive has really just emerged in the last 30 years. At the turn of the century, you would have found most evangelicals in the United States coming very close to promoting a socialist vision. They were doing the majority of the work in inner cities related to immigration and healthcare. And it was really only after the Second World War and the perception of the rising power of progressive religious voices across the spectrum weighing in on how the state should respond to social crisis and social needs, that there was a very concerted effort on the right to divide Christendom into these two categories and to discredit and silence progressive voices and then to align the evangelical world with a conservative political agenda. And that really began to take hold in the late 50s and was given further fire in the 60s. But most evangelicals today would not recognize their counterpart from 100 years ago.
Many years ago, 10 years ago or so, I read a book by a guy named Steve Prothero, who's the head of the religion department at Boston University, called The American Jesus. And he traced how the notion of Jesus and Christians' relationship to Jesus has evolved and changed from the Puritans through contemporary culture. Is that at the root of that, or is the split between evangelicals and the rest of the Christian churches more a political divide? Do you think it's more theological or political?
It's definitely more political. In fact, it's been interesting to me as a theologian who loves to discuss religious views, particularly with people who don't share my views. It's very hard to get actually in-depth theological discussions happening across this political divide because most particularly on the right, there's not necessarily a high level of biblical literacy or well thought through theological grounds for the political positions that are being taken. For instance, it's very hard to find theological justification in the Christian scriptures for this kind of all-out opposition to LGBTQ issues. So therefore, it's been a political discussion. It has not been a theological discussion.
And Asma Houdin, before we take a break here, what about in Islam? I mean, there are more than a billion Muslims worldwide. I mean, defining Islam in any overarching way is also difficult because there are different bites at the apple when it comes to how people interpret the Quran and how people practice Islam. Do you find any analogous challenges and issues in Islam, like the ones that Dr. Jones is talking about?
Well, I mean, with respect to the American Muslim community specifically, in the way that its experience intersects with the political climate in this country, I think that it really depends. Again, as you were saying, depending on where you fall in this full sort of scope of diversity and where your views fall with respect to some of these culture war issues, it's going to impact you in different ways. And mm-hmm. I mean, and the full sort of diversity is across the spectrum. I think the Muslim community to date doesn't understand the full impact potentially of some of these changes, for instance, the legalization of same-sex marriage and the impact of that on Muslim institutions that that might not agree with that position theologically. But the general sort of perspective in the community is that when it comes to fighting for the civil rights of others, and definitely within the scope of Islamic theology, there's no real justification for limiting the rights under a secular framework for others simply on the basis of our religious views.
Asma Houdin is the founder and editor-in-chief of altmuslima.com. The Reverend Dr. Serene Jones is the president of the Union Theological Seminary in New York. It's Living Questions here on Midday. It's our monthly series that examines the role of religion in the public sphere. We'll have more with Asma Houdin and Serene Jones when we come back from a quick break, and you are welcome to join us when we do come back. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap. My guest is going to be Heather Mazur. She was a candidate in the Democratic primary for governor back in 2014. She's been kind of off the radar for a little while, but she's just announced a new initiative that we'll talk a little bit about tomorrow. We'll also talk about what's going on in the news, including the now very crowded field of people also entering this year's Democratic primary to face likely Republican candidate Larry Hogan in next year's gubernatorial election. We'll also talk to Charles Bethea. He is the curator at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture. They've got a terrific exhibition on the African American painter Jacob Lawrence there, and we'll talk to him a little bit about that. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's Living Questions. It's our monthly series on the role of religion in the public sphere. We're talking about religious freedom, both here and around the world. The Reverend Dr. Serene Jones joins us from New York. She's the president of the Union Theological Seminary, the first woman to hold that position in that institution's storied 180-year history. Asma Houdin is with us on the line from Washington, D.C. She's a lawyer, a scholar of religious liberty, and the founder and editor-in-chief of altmuslima.com. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can email us, midday@wipr.org, and follow us on Twitter. You can find us @MiddayTomHall. So, Dr. Jones, when people hear the term religious freedom, when the students at the Union Theological Seminary encounter that notion and consider that idea, a lot of people fear that they use religious freedom, loosely defined, as a cover to deny certain people certain rights. There's the issue of limiting access to contraception, which is very much in the news just in these last couple of days. You mentioned LGBTQ issues, as Ms. Houdin did as well. When you instruct your students at the Union Theological Seminary, you're training the clergy of the future. How do you couch our understanding of religious freedom, and how does one avoid having one person's religious beliefs and be in conflict with another's?
Well, two basic things. One is generally when we speak of religious freedom, in the context of the multi-faith traditions that are discussed and taught at Union. At the core of religious freedom is an affirmation, fundamentally, of human freedom. The freedom to express, the freedom to live as you choose, the freedom to love as you choose, to determine what happens to your body and how your workplace happens and how your life unfolds. So you can't separate basic claims about what it means to be free as a human being from religious freedoms. Secondly, it is absolutely true that historically, in the United States, and most particularly in the last 30 years, religious freedom has been used as a cover to promote the religious perspectives of one group of conservative Christians over and against the vast majority of other Christians and people of other faiths who don't hold those views. So far from being about religious freedom, it's actually used as a sort of weapon to deny freedoms.
How would you summarize or assess then the freedom of, for example, the University of Notre Dame or the Little Sisters of the Poor to deny access to contraception in their healthcare coverage because that is something that is fundamental to their religious belief? How do we reckon that religious belief with a secular government policy that attempts to make access to reproductive health available to all Americans?
That's exactly the point where you see a particular religious community's understanding of freedom come into conflict with the basic freedoms and understandings of human dignity promoted by the Constitution and embedded in our laws. And religious freedom in this country has never been meant as a position that one can take that overrides basic laws and constitutional values and rights. And that's precisely what's being called into question in these positions, that somehow a religious community, because of its beliefs, is exempted from basic constitutional and legal protections. My position on this is, as a religious person, we're not called to be exempted. Actually, we're called to be exemplary when it comes to the protections of rights.
How would you advise the Little Sisters of the Poor to be exemplars of constitutional rights, then, in this case?
In this case, if they are receiving any kind of federal money, and if they are employing people to work in their context, and they are working with communities that do not share their religious values, it is not permissible for them to impose those values upon them.
Mm-hmm. And Azmahuddin, you worked for a while as a lawyer doing religious liberty cases. What kinds of cases were you involved in? I guess you were with a nonprofit law firm that specialized in religious liberty litigation. Can you give us an example of the kinds of cases that you argued?
Well, I mean, I was involved in cases pretty much the full range of religious liberty issues, from issues that we generally would consider non-controversial, such as the ability to grow a beard in prison, which was one of our Supreme Court cases that we handled at my law firm, to the right to build a house of worship or to expand a house of worship, which is an issue that the Muslim community is definitely dealing with in terms of a lot of local opposition in some of the communities. All the way to some of the things that we're talking about right now. In fact, our firm is the firm who represents Little Sisters of the Poor, and for that matter, a number of other nonprofits who had similar objections.
Well, it's interesting. I didn't realize that you actually represented them. And what is your argument then for the Little Sisters of the Poor? Or what was your argument?
Well, I mean, earlier you asked about how to define and discuss religious freedom. And I think it's important to understand that religious freedom is a concept that is about the relationship between the government and the individual, right? It's ultimately about what the government can and cannot do. And I think that sort of centrality and sort of the jurisprudence around that has really allowed me to have a lot of clarity and to sort of sift through some of these politically charged issues, because you can focus in on precisely that jurisprudence and the way that it has time and again sort of created, it has a balancing test built into it that has worked quite well in terms of balancing the government's interest and the interests of the religious believer at issue. And so in the case of, you know, Little Sister of the Poor, earlier Dr. Jones was talking about religious freedom is inherently intertwined with human rights, and part of that is that it has to do with what humans think is their duty to God, right? That's like a huge element of what we think of in terms of religion and conscience, right? How are we going to be judged? What is right and wrong? And that is a strong, you know, it's a very strong factor in the lives of many traditional religious believers or believers generally. And so to that end, the way that the court dealt with the Little Sister of the Poor case and other similar cases, both the lower courts and the Supreme Court, that's what they do. They use a test that says, you know, is there sincerely held belief? If so, is there that's been substantially burdened? And if so, does the government have a compelling interest? And has it made its case that it cannot serve that interest in any other way other than to limit this religious freedom for the believer at issue? And that's a very, you know, it's a test that's designed to say, okay, we understand there's a compelling government interest. Is there a way to serve that interest and without having to trample on other people's religious rights? And so I'm a big believer in that balancing test and that process. And I think that when it is achieved, you can have a live and let live situation.
If you could work with me here, we're going to take a couple of phone calls. Dr. Jones and Ms. Udin, we're going to go to Joe in Lutherville. Joe, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yes, thanks. And thank you for the interesting conversation. So I've long viewed this notion that religious freedom is under threat in the United States as a canard perpetuated by the right wing of the Republican Party, primarily for simple political purposes. It is not religion that is under attack here in the United States. It's secularism, and there are myriad examples, ranging from the continuing attempt to insert religious dogma into the teaching of biology, with states continuing to promote the teaching of creationism. We have end runs around Roe v. Wade at the state level, based on Christian fundamentalist views. We have a de facto violation of Article 6 of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, which prohibits a religious test for public office, because virtually every Republican has to pledge fealty to Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. I could go on, but I think it's ridiculous to assert that there's any threats to religious freedom here. It's secularism that's under attack.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you for your call. Dr. Jones, I mean, what do you think? Is it secularism that's actually under attack, and are non-religious people and atheists to be accorded the same religious freedom as people who are believers?
Well, absolutely. Everyone needs to be accorded the same freedoms, and I do agree that it's a political cover. It's not fundamentally a religious issue, although there are people for whom it is. And I think that what's under attack is not just secularism, but I think it's the religious orientation and beliefs of vast numbers of Christians who are progressives, who don't hold those values, as well as people in other religious traditions, Buddhist, Muslim, Hindu, humanist, who are not represented by those voices. I also think that it's important to make a distinction between protecting an individual's right to, in the privacy of their own home and life, practice their religious beliefs. That needs to be distinguished from a person's right to impose the strictures of that belief on someone who does not hold those beliefs. And I think that's one of the additional issues that comes into how we think about what religious freedom is.
Let's go to another call. Fawn in Abingdon, welcome to Midday with Asma Udin and Serene Jones.
I do have a really specific point. I have 7 granddaughters. I have 4 daughters. And I feel myself, we are all Presbyterian, Methodist, Protestant Christians. There is, I think, a very big point here that you cannot always choose where you're going to be employed. You may not be able to find employment except at this particular place. Now, the employment being offered, if that company, that business, is able to take their moral precept and take away contraception, for instance, then that's wrong, because they offered a job into the public sphere. It would be different if it was a cloister or monastery or something where you said, look, you can't join us or be employed unless you are one of us. Fine, they would have whatever they want. But this business of a baker refusing to cook, bake a cake for a homosexual couple on basis of religion, well, then you shouldn't have a publicly offered business. Do a contract business, offer it up privately. You can do what you want. But when you're in the public sphere, I think it has to be American straight up and down. Those founding fathers, they knew what they were doing when they talked about freedom of religion. They were not saying Sharia. They were saying the opportunity. They knew very well that they were putting in place freedoms. Our first is freedom of speech. And it just, there's such to me a horror that we would have an employer do that to a woman. And force. Right.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the call. We take your point, Fawn. Asma Uddin, the Supreme Court will in fact be considering this in this term, this case in Colorado where the baker refused to make a cake for a couple of guys who wanted to get married in Massachusetts, actually. So what are the legal precedents for this, and what is the lens through which this should be looked at and decided?
Well, I think I want to respond to the point of, you know, people not always having a choice of employment and the issues that faces. But I want to actually counter that by raising another very important point, and the idea that a lot of these, you know, social services that are, you know, religious hospitals and universities and so on, they're all based in these sort of deeply held religious beliefs and motivate these individuals and these groups to create these institutions to serve the public. And so on the one hand, we can think of it as like, well, they already exist and now they have to conform to certain practices. But we also have to think, well, what is the incentive there for them to keep doing so if it's not a representation of their beliefs? And the way that it impacts the motivation, inspiration to begin with, to be able to start religious institutions, if the idea is that at some point the government can tell you how to and how not to run your business on the in terms of when it comes to these questions of conformance to your religious beliefs. It's an intrusion to religious autonomy, and it's also in the long term and the short term in terms of these institutions shutting down. A problem from an employment perspective, because all those jobs are gone and there's no further incentive for these religious individuals to create these jobs to begin with.
Sure. Dr. Jones, there's increasing cynicism and frankly fleeing from religion in American culture. The Pew Research on Religion studies have indicated that fewer and fewer people are identifying with the religion that they were born into. For the first time, fewer than 50% of Americans identify as Christian, white and Christian in particular. And then we have these events like the horrible massacre in Las Vegas, in which everybody's the political class are quick to go on Twitter and on television and say our thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families. And it's almost like that phrase, our thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families, becomes like a meme. It's like a GIF that gets repeated on your Facebook feed. And it just rings so hollow to people, given the enormity of the problem of gun violence in this country, both in terms of massacres and what happens on a daily basis in cities across this country. How do you wrestle with that, with the literally lack of faith in religious perspective to inform how we understand this kind of stuff?
Well, you're absolutely right. Across the board, participation in religious communities is declining, not at a slow but a rapid rate, and we're no longer a predominantly white Christian nation. And taking in what that means and what that does to identity, I think, is a very important issue to consider, particularly when you look at the kinds of fears and religious biases that came to the surface in the last election. But what's interesting about the Pew study and about the tracing these trends is many of the people who are leaving traditional religious communities are becoming the unaffiliated or what are called the spiritual but not religious. At Union, a third of our entering classes for the last 5 years have been these nuns, the no religious affiliation, but they're spiritual. And I think that we still have in this country deep spiritual human yearnings for meaning, and particularly in this political climate, we're seeing an increase of an articulation of a need for moral frames, a need for deep reflection on the meaning of our lives and who we are as a nation. Many of the sins of our past are coming up to grab a hold of us, and we're having to wrestle with them in a way that we haven't. And you might not cast those as traditionally religious questions, but they're spiritual and they're existential, and they're very, very alive right now.
And Asma Uddin, you wrote a piece last spring in Teen Vogue. It was during May, during Ramadan, about President Trump and his message, his Ramadan message, about how the frame that he continues to apparently view Islam is through the lens of terrorism. How is that playing out? I mean, obviously we have the Muslim ban, and that's all now in the courts and working its way through that legal process. But sort of on a deeper, more visceral level, how is that playing out in the conversation in the Muslim community about the status of Muslims in America today?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that rhetoric, his Ramadan message, is a continuation of the rhetoric that we heard during the elections and during many of the several of the debates, where the lens through which Muslims are viewed is necessarily one of securitization, of extremism and terrorism, and are the communities and each individual Muslim's worth and value in this framework is only to the extent to which we're somehow able to prevent that extremism or play a role in encountering terrorism. And I think that obviously is, I mean, again, looking at the question of religion and religious freedom is about being fundamentally rooted in human rights and human dignity, and to be reduced in that way simply on the basis of our religious identity is something that is deeply troubling and demoralizing.
Let me ask you real quickly as we finish up here, Ms. Uddin, within hours of the Vegas massacre, ISIS had claimed responsibility for that event. There doesn't seem to be much actual justification for that claim at this point in the investigation. What was your impression, your take on the media coverage and the reaction in the early hours to what happened in Las Vegas last week?
Well, I think the concern is something that spans beyond Las Vegas massacre to, unfortunately, the constant violence that tends to shake our world in the modern age. And the fact that a lot of these mass killings and are immediately sort of like the presumption tends to be that it's done by an extremist who claims to be Muslim, and not specifically ISIS. And then that sort of assumption has to be, that's the initial assumption, that it needs to be countered by the actual facts. And I think that, I share the concern with, everyone in the Muslim community that, both American and most likely abroad as well, that, every time one of these things happen, we should sort of brace for the revelation of who did it. And if there's any connection to Islam, the impact it's going to have on our daily existence.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry that's all the time we have. I'm very grateful to you both for your thoughtful perspective today. And thanks so much. And I hope we can have you back sometime soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Reverend Dr. Serene Jones is the president of the Union Theological Seminary in New York and the immediate past president of the American Academy of Religion. Asma Uddin is the founder and editor-in-chief of altmuslima.com and the co-founder of AltFem Magazine and AltVentures Media. This has been another edition of Living Questions, Midday's monthly series examining the role of religion in the public sphere, which we produce in collaboration with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. By the way, next Thursday night, October 19th, the ICJS will sponsor a program called Religious Communities Under Attack. What Can You Do to End Hate in Baltimore? That event starts at 7 o'clock. It's at the Jewish Museum of Maryland over on Lloyd Street, downtown in Baltimore. We'll have more information, and you can hear all of the conversations in our Living Questions series at wypr.org/livingquestions. And our thanks, by the way, to Annie Brackmeyer of the ICJS for her help with our program today. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, a review of the new show at Baltimore's Single Carrot Theater. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick is in the house. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.